Hello and welcome to the Deep Sea Podcast, Pressurized, a short, punchy version of our main feed that gets right to the scientific point. If you like what you hear and you'd like to hear the full episode, you can find it in the same feed. And now, to get right to the point. That beautifully leads into our topic for this episode, love in the deep sea. Who can we talk to about reproductive strategies in the deep sea?
I know a guy.
You know a guy. Do you know the guy?
The godfather of deep sea reproduction, who happens to be Craig Young.
I'm joined by Craig Young, director of the Oregon Institute of Marine Biology. Thanks so much for taking some time to have a chat today. For our Valentine's episode, we wanted to sort of talk about love in the deep sea, which is the trendy, sexy name that I've put over essentially reproductive strategies in the deep sea. And so, of course, you were the first person that came to mind to actually discuss this. Before we get into the organisms themselves, what would you say are the sort of main hurdles that a deep sea organism is facing when they want to reproduce?
Well, there are a number of them. One of them is that in many habitats of the deep sea, animals are spread out quite a bit. You don't necessarily find a male and a female that are very close together. Somehow they have to figure out how to get the eggs and the sperm together in the same place. Another, of course, is that if they live in something like a hydrothermal vent or on a seamount, then it might be a very long distance before the little babies, the larvae, can find another place to live. And so there have to be mechanisms for them to disperse for sometimes long distances in order to make that happen. Perhaps a third difficulty is that if they do send babies, larvae, up into the water to disperse around, not necessarily a lot of food to eat in the deep water column. It's not like being up in the shallows where there's plenty of sunlight to feed phytoplankton. So something that these animals had to have adapted to over evolutionary time is figuring out how to actually nourish the larvae while they are dispersing. So I think those are three of the big ones.
That sounds tricky. What are some of the reproductive strategies actually employed by, particularly invertebrates, because I know that's your key area?
Maybe a good place to start would be to talk about what the traditional idea was about how animals should reproduce in the deep sea. It has not always been very easy to work in the deep sea, especially when you're trying to figure out how animals are making their living and how they're reproducing and so on. So there was a lot of speculation in the old days. Two of the major speculations were the timing of reproduction in the deep sea. Orton, back in 1914, I think, pointed out that temperature is one of the main controllers of reproductive timing in animals. He worked entirely in shallow water, but he speculated that in the deep sea, maybe if temperature were quite constant all the time, that these animals wouldn't be able to use that as a cue. So for many, many decades, folks thought that animals in the deep sea probably would reproduce continuously all year round, not having any peaks in seasonal reproduction like they do in shallow water. And then in the 1940s and 50s, a very influential scientist, Gunnar Thorsen in Denmark, came along and he speculated that probably there's nothing to feeding larvae in the water column. And therefore, animals on the ocean floor probably would not have larvae, or if they did, the larvae would not feed. So those are two of the major paradigms that people worried about for a long time. And it turns out that both of them were wrong. And so now we can start there, I think, and talk about the fact that there really are animals in the deep sea that reproduce. They don't necessarily use temperature as a cue. They use something else. And there really are animals in the deep sea that have larvae. In fact, a great many of them have larvae. And that includes species that have larvae that feed in the water column.
What are the main groups that you work with? I know you're pretty broadly spread over the invertebrates, but you've got some favorites.
I think my lab is published on most of the invertebrate phyla, one way or the other. I started working on tunicate larvae as a graduate student, but then adopted the echinoderms because the methods are very straightforward for spawning them and obtaining the larvae and so on. So for many years, I worked on echinoderms, and some of the first larvae that we reared from the deep sea were echinoderm larvae, asteroids and echinoids, sea urchins and starfish. There was a lot of interest in how animals at hydrothermal vents might be able to disperse from one vent to another. Nobody knew when we started whether they had larvae or not, or whether they brooded their embryos like a chicken sitting on an egg and then just kept them close to home. And we were able to show, for example, that the larvae of tube worms at hydrothermal vents and at methane seeps, those animals do produce larvae, and the larvae have enough yolk in them that they can disperse to the next vent or to the next seep up the line. They don't swim for a very long period of time, but we were able to solve that problem of how they get from place to place. And it turns out it's not that different from the way animals do it in shallow water.
I was going to ask about the sort of the patchy habitats. Even though the chances of finding a mate in the abyss are quite slim, there's plenty of abyss to land on. But if you're a specialist for, say, a cold seep or a hydrothermal vent or a whale fall was the other one that cropped to mind, especially because some of these habitats are quite ephemeral. Like you'll get a few generations and then they may die and there'll be a new spot. So how they're finding and colonizing their very niche habitat?
That question is right on the money. You know, the very first paper that described hydrothermal vents in literature was a paper in Science back in the 1970s. And in that paper, the author said, you know, one of the really puzzling things about this is how in the world can these animals get to another habitat? They knew already that they were spaced out quite far. And that was one of the major puzzles that was in the literature about hydrothermal vents for many years. I collaborated with Donald Monahan at University of Southern California and with Laura Molinow at Woods Hole when we first reared the larvae of Riftia, the giant tube worms. It was a great team because Lauren had expertise in the currents around hydrothermal vents, and Donald had interest in the physiology of these animals as they're drifting. And so part of the answer to your question is that in some of these apparently isolated habitats, the currents are actually rectified and go in a particular direction. So on the East Pacific Rise, for example, where there are vents that are spaced quite a long ways apart, the predominant currents run in the direction of the vents. And that means that the probability of drifting away from the vent site is much lower than it would be in a situation that has different currents. So that appears to be part of the answer, at least for vents. But we still don't know the answer for things like whale falls. And we don't know the answer necessarily for seamounts and other kinds of isolated habitats either.
We touched upon coordination and timing. If they don't use temperature, what sort of signals are there to allow animals to coordinate mating?
A few years ago, some of your colleagues in Britain demonstrated that there are seasonal pulses of detritus falling down from the surface. And it's long been thought, of course, that most of the nutrition on the deep sea floor comes from surface productivity. The diatoms and so on eventually run out of nutrients and die and sink to the ocean floor, and that provides food. But photographic evidence, time-lapse photography on the ocean floor demonstrated that that food comes in major pulses. And as soon as that was discovered, people grasped onto the idea that that must be the thing that's controlling seasonality. Essentially, animals wait for the pulse and then they have enough food so that they can shunt nutrients into their gonad, produce a gonad, gametogenesis continues until they're ready to spawn, and then you have seasonal reproduction. So that seems to be still one of the most likely possibilities. But I can tell you a number of years ago, I, being a young man who was somewhat skeptical, said, well, this is all a correlation. You know, maybe there's something else going on too, or maybe it's not directly tied to the food pulses. And so we got a grant from the National Science Foundation, actually turned into three grants from the National Science Foundation to try and test the idea that seasonality actually is driven by phytodetrital pulses from the surface. So we did experiments on the ocean floor in the Bahamas where we fed things at different seasons using submersibles to go down and put the food in. We did experiments in the laboratory in refrigerated replicated tanks where we provided phytodetritus produced artificially in the laboratory at different times of the year on different periods of time. And I think we spent probably 3, 4, maybe 5 years running those kinds of experiments, different ways. And if you're familiar with the literature in this field at all, you will know that there is not such an answer in the literature. There's never been a single publication that has used an experimental test of the phytodetrital hypothesis because they were all non-definitive. We couldn't demonstrate that phytodetritus even caused reproduction to happen. The only real answer that we had is that if you feed them too much food, feed them more than they would ever get on the ocean floor, they reproduce like crazy, and sometimes they can reproduce for long periods of time. So we know that reproduction is tied to food, but nobody's been able to demonstrate that the timing of reproduction can be changed by changing the timing of the food fall.
It might be more of a sort of energy budget thing, which if you're really sparse, if you're really scattered over, say, the abyssal plains, and you've finally gained enough food that you can dedicate some of your energy budget to reproduction, maybe the animals close enough for your gametes to have a hope of meeting are also having a really good time. And so maybe it's almost totally detached from chronology in that sense, but just when the conditions are right, they tend to be right for the area. And so if anyone's got any spare cash in the coffers, they spend it on reproduction.
Well, that's a great idea. The problem with that idea, of course, is that you would not expect those chance encounters with other reproductive individuals to happen always in the same season. And yet we know that quite a few animals, especially on the slope, do have very seasonal reproductive timing.
Oh, damn, I thought I'd solved it. Sorry.
Well, maybe you did.
I'll try again.
We'll think about that a little bit more.
I doubt late on a Wednesday night I'm going to find the answer.
Let me just pick up another thread from that, which is that if food is actually controlling the seasonality of reproduction, then you would expect animals that have a continuous supply of food to be able to reproduce all the time. And we have examples of those kinds of animals in the deep sea at hydrothermal vents, for example, where the adults might depend on sulfide and the sulfide is there throughout the entire year, or at methane seeps, where you have bubbling methane that provides the carbon and the energy for organisms to metabolize and presumably to reproduce all throughout the year. And so we and others have looked at the possibility of seasonal breeding. And it turns out that many of them don't breed continuously. Some of the hydrothermal vent ones do, but the methane seep ones do not. They have tightly constrained seasonal reproduction that seems to be tied to surface productivity. So one of my graduate students, for example, Caitlin Plowman, who's just finishing her PhD and looking for a postdoc, incidentally, if anybody's listening.
We sailed with Caitlin, actually. I think we've met.
Oh, that's right. You did. You sailed the Mariana Trench together, didn't you?
Yeah, I think there's a nice picture of her holding one of the supergiants.
That's right. I know the picture. Caitlin looked at the timing of reproduction in methane seep mussels up in the North Atlantic, in New England, and also in the Gulf of Mexico and at different depths of the water column. And even though all of those animals have a continuous source of food, she found that depending on the region, the timing of that reproductive pulse changes. And it seems to be tied very nicely to surface productivity as indicated by satellite ocean color. And so that suggests that these animals actually are tying their reproductive timing not into the availability of energy and carbon on the ocean floor, but maybe they need something else. And we've speculated, and others have said this too, that you can't really make sperm, for example, without having lipids and certain lipids. Those lipids that are required come from phytoplankton. And so perhaps even though the energy is available all the time, maybe phytoplankton is required. And until that phytoplankton falls to the ocean floor, they can't actually make gonads. So that's a working hypothesis, not yet proven.
That's incredible. There's essential elements that are missing in the diet.
Right. And so the idea that the timing of food falls is the only thing that controls reproduction might not be entirely true. But on the other hand, if those food falls include diatoms that have the right lipids, maybe it is true. A lot of invertebrates are scattered out over the ocean floor, and they have the challenge that they have to spawn up into the water column. So the eggs are released up into the water, and the sperm are released up into the water, and the eggs and the sperm have to find each other. And that's tricky because sperm typically don't swim for very long. They run out of energy relatively quickly. And so in deep sea habitats where the densities of animals might be fairly low, it's a bit of a puzzle how the eggs and sperm manage to find themselves in that enormous volume of water.
Playing the numbers, is it just releasing as many as possible? But that seems wasteful for the deep sea. The deep sea is very efficient.
It does, yeah. And the other thing is that oftentimes the fecundities of animals aren't as high in the deep sea because food may be more limiting in the deep ocean. And so the gonads don't get quite as large. So playing that numbers game becomes more challenging. They might produce hundreds of thousands of eggs, for example, instead of many millions of eggs for an organism of a particular size. We wondered about that for a long time. And then my colleague, Paul Tyler. He and I were on a cruise in the Bahamas together back in the early 80s. And I think we were both in the submersible at the same time, in the Johnson Sea Link submersible. We were on the bottom going around taking pictures of sea urchins and picking up animals that could be spawned in the laboratory on the ship. And we noticed the animals were sitting next to each other. They were pairing. Lots of pairs of animals or triplets of animals that were all touching spines. Normally, during most of the year, these particular animals are pretty rare. You have to run the submersible for hours in order to pick up enough to spawn. But here, all of a sudden, we could pick them up two at a time or three at a time or five at a time in little groups. The light kind of went off in both of our heads at about the same time, I think, that these things are probably reproducing. They're probably getting together to reproduce. So we started picking up pairs and putting them in individual compartments so that we could see what their reproductive condition was. And lo and behold, we were right. These were all animals that were just about ready to release their eggs and sperm. They had packed gonads that were mature. And so we had caught them right in the middle of the spawning season, just before spawning.
You'd really interrupted, actually. There's nothing subtle about a sub suddenly turning the lights on.
No, we're absolutely shameless about that sort of thing, actually.
Lovely romantic moment, really.
Well, we continued along those lines for a couple of years after that. That was in the spring, in May, I think. When we went back in February, which was before the gonads were ripe and ready to spawn, there was no sign of pairs. These things were wandering independently around on the bottom, apparently random, probably looking for food, but certainly not pairing up with other individuals of their species. Turns out that's what they do. They wander around and feed for most of the year. And then during a short period of time, right before they're ready to go, if they happen to encounter an animal of the same species, they stay with them so that they can make sure that the sperm and the eggs get together at the same time. But the more we looked, the more we found. We found this sort of pairing in ophiuroids and in a lot of different kinds of echinoids now in the deep sea. As far as we know, it's not a phenomenon that you see very much in shallow water where the density, their close relatives are actually much higher. Let me just tell you about another related thing that we discovered, and that is that some of the sea urchins in the deep sea have specially modified sperm that can swim longer than a typical shallow water sperm. If you dilute the sperm of a shallow water sea urchin or starfish in water, they start swimming like crazy and they run out of energy, usually within an hour or two. So they have to find an egg to fertilize during that very, very brief period of time. So they're going to be carried in the currents just as the eggs of animals nearby are also being carried in the currents. And it's really, it would seem to me, kind of a random encounter situation, although sea urchin sperm do have the ability to detect eggs pheromonally. But what we noticed, we did the ultrastructure of some of these sperm from various deep sea animals. And it turned out that some of the sperm that have very large heads also have big globules of lipid hanging from their mitochondria. Mitochondria is a little powerhouse that provides the energy to wag their tails and swim. And we found that some of these, especially the soft-bodied deep-sea sea urchins, echinotherids, have these big lipid structures, which is extra energy on the back end of the sperm head. So we actually put these in cold seawater and let them swim around and found out that these particular deep sea species can swim for hours instead of minutes, many, many hours, like 24 or something like that. It seems to be an adaptation in deep water so that these organisms can have a longer window of opportunity for actually fertilizing than the denser animals in shallow water would.
That's amazing. And having lipid sores within an individual cell, like the metabolic pathways are quite complex for lipid energy release. That's a really complex sperm.
It is, yeah. And nobody has actually worked on mechanisms at all. All we know is that there's a correlation between the amount of lipid and the length of time that these sperm can swim. There seem to be other mechanisms for doing something similar. We ran into a sea urchin called Physocystis, about 2,000 meters off the Big Island of Hawaii. And we looked at its eggs and sperm, and its sperm are absolutely bizarre. It has two different kinds of sperm. It has ones that just look just like any sea urchin sperm would, but it also has other sperm in the same gonad that have two tails. One of them is pointing forward and the other one is pointing backward, kind of like a push me, pull you. And if you remember Dr. Doolittle,
yeah,
we never did figure out exactly what they're doing, but the hypothesis is that these very elaborate sperm probably get all tangled up with other sperm, and they make clusters of sperm that carry the one-headed ones through the water column without diluting them too much. And so you have a packet of sperm that drifts, and maybe it can drift for quite a long time until it runs into an egg or many eggs.
And maybe it drifts faster than the eggs do. Maybe it's better at drifting than a single sphere.
That's exactly right. Also, there's a possibility that if you have all this stuff tangled up together, that the sperm don't run out of energy so quickly because they might not begin swimming if they're tangled up with a bunch of others and very little water to dilute them in, very little opportunity opportunity to wag their tails. So we don't know what's going on, but there are lots of interesting observations like that that have to be there for some reason.
It's too specific. Yeah, it's serving some sort of function. That's yeah. Both of those stories are incredible. Like, I'm totally unaware of these strategies.
It was discovered early on that hydrothermal vent tube worms also have weird sperm. Those sperm are all tied together into a bundle where all the sperm are attached together and the tails all stick out in the same direction. We're not exactly sure what's going on there either. Some indication that some tube worms actually attach those sperm bundles to an adjacent female. That's certainly not the case for many species. We suspect that, again, that this may be a mechanism for allowing dispersal without actually using up the energy until they arrive at a female.
Usually you get sperm competition. Usually sperm are quite
exactly.
selfish, but sperm teamwork is new to me.
It seems to be not terribly uncommon.
Is there anything you've recently discovered that has really got you scratching your head or really excited about it?
Yes. As a matter of fact, a lot of people in recent years have become very interested in how far the larvae of deep sea animals can go. It was discovered a few years ago, for example, that some of the animals found in the Gulf of Mexico or off Barbados at methane seeps are very closely related to the same genera and species of animals that live off West Africa or in methane seeps off Portugal, for example, suggesting that maybe the larvae of these animals can connect clear across ocean basins. Now, that's a long swim for a little guy, long drift. And in order to do that, these larvae have to be able to stay in the water column, presumably feeding for an incredibly long period of time. So one of the things that we discovered recently, collaboration with Sean Arellano and Bob Reinhoek's lab, and Bob's a geneticist, we discovered that some of these deep sea mussel larvae and snail larvae from seeps can actually go up and drift into surface waters. They're not required to drift in deep water. And that gives them access to much faster currents. And because they are up there in a place where they can feed, they can also stay in the water for a very long time. So we've been able to show that at least one species of mussel larva has a dispersal period of at least a year, probably even longer. That provides many thousands of kilometers of range and many, many months where the possibility of finding a habitat is high. Miriam Sibaway in France took a wonderful picture in the deep sea of two sea urchins walking alongside each other. And because they'd been eating the sediment on the bottom, you could follow their path for a very long time. And it was obvious that these two animals had been walking together for vast distances, feeding right next to each other. Very romantic sort of a situation, it looked like, holding tube feet maybe as they walk along together eating. Paul and I found the same species in the Bahamas that had been photographed so elegantly by Miriam. We looked at the gonads of those animals. It turned out they were hermaphrodites. And so each one was a male and a female. And it wasn't a matter of a male and a female having to find each other in order to spawn.
You've doubled your odds of stumbling upon. Yeah, you just have to find another member of the same species.
Yeah, in an evolutionary sense, it probably made sense because it reduces inbreeding. But here we have hermaphrodites that are pairing up together and walking along and presumably spawning at the same time.
Thanks so much for your time, Craig.
I was a little worried that we wouldn't have enough to talk about, but I think we did pretty well there.
So we've done invertebrates, a little bit on some of the interesting fish reproduction. We all know about the parasitic males in the anglerfish. That's a sort of extreme sexual dimorphism there. The male is this basically a testicle with a nose that smells out the female and then fuses with her and becomes part of her body. And she can have multiple males, which are essentially little testicles basically grafted onto her body that she can use as she wishes. One of my favorite ones is probably the deep sea lizard fish. This is a really gnarly looking beast because it's got this big toothy grin. They're sit and wait predators and they might go months without moving. They're just super low energy. They stay perfectly still. And then as soon as they detect something smaller than a sub, small enough to eat, they go off like a rocket. They're one of the few deep sea fish with a muscular paddle shaped tail. So they are about explosive speed when they get the chance. And they're really spread out. They don't move around much. So how are they reproducing? Well, they're simultaneous hermaphrodites. So they're both male and female at the same time. So at least that solves the problem a little bit. That means any two that meet can reproduce. But the thing that gets me is there's got to be some behavioral signaling to that. Like these things are like a bear trap. They're so reactive to anything in their proximity. How do they approach each other? How do they find each other to begin with? And then how do they approach each other sort of waving a white flag, or maybe a white flag with a little heart on it to say, you know, I'm here for horniness, don't eat me. And I'm sure there is the occasional mistaken eating going on.
How do they decide who's going to be the mummy and who's going to be the daddy?
That is another interesting thing, because in some of the hermaphroditic worms, it is less energetically demanding to be male than female, because you put a lot more energy into the eggs than you do the sperm. And so...
Ain't that the truth?
when these hermaphroditic worms come together, it's actually a battle. It's not romance in the deep sea. They try and inseminate the other one while biting off the penis at the same time. So is there some competition? Do they essentially spar to see who is forced to be the female, since it's not as energetically rewarding? We spoke to Mike a bit about squid reproduction. So let's see how the cephalopods find love in the deep sea.
Well, a lot of people know that cephalopods, squids and octopods, have a modified arm to transfer the spermatophores. But it turns out that's not actually true. That some of them do, but particularly when you get to the deep sea, the squids don't have that modified arm. What they have is an elongate penis, which they use instead. And it actually extends out through the funnel to inject spermatophores into the female in various really unexpected locations, like the back of her head, or hypodermically injected into her arms and things like that. And we actually saw that in action a few years ago on a dive from the Okeanos Explorer. And Henk-Jan Hoving and I published a paper on it. That was another of these really rapid turnaround papers where we saw the squid, and then 6 months later, it was ink on paper in a publication, because it was the first observation of mating by one of these deep sea species that uses the elongated tip of the male reproductive tract, otherwise known as the penis, to inject the spermatophores into the females. The other one that you might think about is, we've always said that octopods care for their young and squids don't. Squids deposit their eggs and then swim away and die. Well, it turns out that's not true either. And the people at Mbari documented that gonadid squids, the female will go down into deep water, being more than 1,000 meters deep, lay an egg mass, and then tow it around with her until they hatch. Now they know that another family does as well, the bathytoothids, will care for their eggs as well. So it's another case of, we were wrong because we were generalizing from shallow water species, but oceanic species do things very differently.
That's amazing.
It just goes to show that the more people drive around looking for stuff, the more they find this stuff. Yeah.
When the sort of sperm packets are indeterminately injected into the female and they sort of navigate their way back to fertilize the eggs, is that the female's body that's gathering them and moving them, or are they mobile in themselves and they're almost seeking within her body?
You've just gotten to one of the questions that I really wish I could answer. Sometimes it makes sense where the sperm packets get implanted, and sometimes it doesn't. And on the ones that it doesn't, we don't know how the sperm gets to the eggs. Like Architeuthis, giant squids, the sperm packets get hypodermically injected into the arms. And we don't know how the sperm gets from there to the eggs. There's no evidence in support of any explanation. We just know it has to.
Yeah.
The one that I was talking about was the first observation of, it's Philidotuthis adami in the Gulf of Mexico, where the female was doing all the work. The male was just hanging on and implanting spermatophores. And where he implants them is underneath the fin on the back of the female, which seems like it wouldn't make sense, except that that is directly opposite to where the openings of the oviducts are. And so if those sperm, when the female's ready, actually dig all the way through the muscle of the mantle, they would be in a really good location to fertilize the eggs. But again, we think that's what happens, but we don't actually know that that's what happens.
On that paper we touched on with the reproduction in the giant squid, there was that fertilized female recently captured, and the surprise from the scientists that it was a single male. And then when that was reported, a weird human layer of monogamy was slapped over that, whereas I would just interpret that as, these are incredibly far apart animals and she happened to only encounter one male. You know, if you find a deep sea angler with only one parasitic male on it, I don't call her monogamous. You know, there are examples where they just happen to encounter more.
Yeah, I think that's the way it is in the deep sea. There is a monogamous squid that I actually accept as the diamond squid, Thysanotuchus rhombus.
Brilliant name.
They're commercially fished, but the Japanese in the Sea of Japan and around Okinawa, when they catch one, they leave it in the water until the other one comes because they are always found in pairs and it's always a male-female pair.
That's heartbreaking.
So they use the one to catch the other. Yeah.
Oh, that's dark.
It's a sort of a sad story, but it's illuminating about their biology.
That is a beautiful Valentine's story, that.
And that was a pressurized version of one of our longer episodes. If you enjoyed that and you would like to hear the full length episode, just match the episode numbers and you'll be able to find the full length version in the feed. Thanks for listening. We'll deep see you next time, and I abyss you already.